ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय,
titled Bhagavatam is the answer to all questions. Do you know where these chapter titles came from? Are they there?
Srinivasamy and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur have a verse at the beginning of every chapter that they summarize the contents. And then usually, sometimes a kind of a loose translation of at least one aspect of that verse.
Okay, because Prabhupada in the purport, the last verse, remarked that all questions regarding the universe and reality can be answered in Srimad Bhagavatam, so he says it's the answer to all questions. So this begins, hearing Atra in this Srimad Bhagavatam, there, and now here's the list. You can see in the word for word, Sarga, statement of the creation of the universe. Visargaha is sub-creation or the secondary creation, the one by Brahma. Cha means also. Stanam, here is called the planetary systems, or you notice how this differs, so the planetary system in the word for word and planetary system here, same one. Oh, I know what it is. We have these same two verses. The first two verses, chapters, are also translated, commented on in Chaitanya Charitamrita. This is Adi Lila, second chapters, 91 and 92. See, the same verses are quoted here. And sometimes you get interesting, Sarga, the creation of the ingredients of the universe. Visarga, the creations of Brahma, that those things which are done by Lord Brahma. First, the agent of the first creation is the first Purusha avatar. And then the second creation is Brahma. Stanam, the maintenance of the creation. The planetary systems, everything. What happens in a way between Sarga or Srishti and Pralaya. So there's the Sarga, Visarga, Stanam, and that they're in the Roda, the winding up, the middle period. That's what's meant by Stanam. Stiti, it's also called Stiti in the later verse in the Bhagavatam. Hoshanam. Here, the favoring of the Lord's devotees. And in the Bhagavatam, how does he say it?
Protection.
Protection. Yeah. Protection by the Lord. And the Lord's special care for the devotees is Poshan. Utaya, the creative impetus, which is also can be translated as impetuses for activity. Now what these mean will be explained in a few next verses. Then Manu Antara. Now literally Manu Antara means the reign of the Manu, of the Manus. As we all should know, how many Manus are there in a day of Brahma?
14.
Huh? 14 Manus in a day of Brahma? Is that right? Okay.
72 yuga cycles.
Huh?
72 yuga cycles.
They last as long as 71 yuga cycles. Right? 14 manus in the day of Brahma. So each one acts 70, multiply that out and we find there's 1,000 yugas, there's 994.
I thought it was 71 and a half.
No, I know the answer, I'll tell you later. No, it's 71.
Oh, I think I know the answer.
Well, you say that. Right now, but here Prabhupada concentrates on what he calls prescribed duties given by manus. And each one of these, the manus hands down the manus and the law books or prescribed duties to mankind. So usually here in these translations, Prabhupada talks about that. Although you'll find that this Puranic has a list of all the manus and like descriptions of what many of them do. And who they are, and who their sons are, and all those things, right? Chiefly in the eighth canto. Yeah. But here, in this one, he calls it changes of manus. The changes of manus. So both two aspects of the manvantara. Antara means a period, just a period of manu. Then the next one is Isha Anuttata, the science of God, he calls it here. What does he call it? Here he calls it a description of the incarnations of the Lord. Now it's really descriptions of the Lord, or accounts of the Lord, huh? Nirodha. Now here, very interestingly, Prabhupada calls Nirodha going back home, back to Godhead. I don't know where that comes from, because later on it's described as, in the second canto, 10th chapter, as the winding up of creation. Because there's a verse that defines each one of these. And there's a commentary, and that's what it is. So I don't know exactly. I mean, in a sense, with the winding up of the individual bondage of material existence is Nirodha, but here it's called, see in the Adi Lila, it's called the winding up of creation. Then Muktihi, liberation, that's the other topic. And then finally, Ashraya. The ultimate shelter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ashraya means shelter. Then, okay, so here we go, we have it here. Here he described Ashraya as the summum bonum. Here Prabhupada harks back to the beginning of Bhagavatam as the absolute truth. And so he uses this Latin phrase. You know what summum bonum means in English? Anyone know? Huh?
The ultimate summum?
No. Uh-huh. The highest good. Bonum is good. So summum is the greatest good. So then the next text goes on, after listing these 10 topics or I covered in Srimad Bhagavatam, it says, the 10th, Dasyamasya, the Dasya, is the 10th one, that is to say, the summum bonum. It says, all of the other nine, are described in order to distinguish or to isolate the summum bonum. So they're distinguished. You may remember, in I guess the first or the second verse of the Bhagavatam in the purport, Prabhupada talks about substance and categories. Well, what he means to say is the summa bonum is the substance, and everything else, the categories, is that which proceed from the substance. In some kind of European philosophical language from somewhere, substance and categories, but that's what it means. So there's the summa bonum, which is the tenth, and the other nine are described to distinguish it. This is the isolated, to distinguish it, distinguish the summa bonum from all others. The way Prabhupada translates it here, well, let's look at the. I like this translation as it's given here, the first one. He does the first and the second together. Here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10 subjects are described. This is the Adi Lila, second chapter. 1, the creation of the ingredients of the cosmos. 2, the creations of Brahma. 3, the maintenance of creation, that's sthana. 4, special favor given to the faithful, osam. 5, impetuses for activity. 6, prescribed duties for law-abiding men, that's the Manu Antara. 7, description of the incarnations of God, Isha Anukata. 8, the winding up of the creation. 9, very precisely here, liberation from gross and subtle material existence. In other words, every time we die, we are liberated from the gross body, but because we are not liberated from the subtle body, we come back. So the trick is to be liberated from the subtle body. And Kapila Dev says in the next canto, devotional service dissolves the subtle body of the living entity. So it's liberation from both gross and subtle. That's why Prabhupada puts it this way, mukti. And 10, the ultimate shelter. This is Ashraya, Supreme Personality of Godhead. The 10th item is the shelter of all others. I'll explain what's meant by shelter. To distinguish this ultimate shelter from the other 9 subjects, the Mahajanas have described these 9, and then directly or indirectly, through prayers or direct explanations. Now between these two versions there's a difference, but Shrutena, by prayers, and the other ones I think says by scripture. Artena, by Arta, explanation, and also Anjasa, which usually means straight, quickly, directly. We've got a little different way of dealing with it here in this one. Shrutena by Vedic evidence, by an Arti calls direct explanations, Anjasa summarily. So I suppose different acharyas have glossed these, read these a little differently. But anyway, you get the idea. So this is the topic. The 9 are there, and then finally the 10th, which is the summum bonum. And these are the topics that are included here in this Bhagavatam. Now this goes on. You see, in text 3, we start to define them. Yeah?
What it means in the second text, they describe the 9. Yeah? But how they distinguish by this tense, by describing the 9?
Well, it says the 9s are described in such a way as to make it clear how they differ from the 10th.
So they describe in relationship.
Yeah. Here, let's go to the other thing. The Prabhupada explains this. We'll go to it right away. We can here's here in the purport, Prabhupada has described the given longer definitions of these. But I will just go to this part here. Two different principles are to be considered herein, namely ashraya, right? That's the tent. It's called ashraya. The object providing shelter and ashrita, the dependents requiring shelter. The ashrita exists under the original principle, the ashraya. The first nine categories described in the first nine cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, from creation to liberation, including the Purusha avatars, the incarnations, the marginal energies, or living entities, the external energy or the material world, all are ashrita. So even Isha Anukuta is in the category of ashrita because it describes the different incarnations who are incarnations of Krishna, who is not an incarnation but the source of all incarnations. The prayers, The prayers of Srimad Bhagavatam, however, aim for the ashraya tattva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, the great souls expert in describing Srimad Bhagavatam have very diligently delineated the other nine categories, sometimes by direct narration and sometimes by indirect narration such as stories. The real purpose of doing this is to know perfectly the absolute transcendent Sri Krishna, for the entire creation, both material and spiritual, rests on the body of Sri Krishna. Can I explain it for you?
No, he again repeats it basically here.
Huh?
He repeats that they describe the mind. But by describing, it is done to know the absolute transcendence. But how by describing others?
Because you describe the nine as being derived from their ashrita. They're derived from, dependent on, in service of the tenth. So they're all described as that way. Huh?
So it would be inaccurate to say that Vishnu is independent?
Vishnu is
independent? It's an inaccurate understanding?
If you read the account of the early chapters of Chaitanya Charitamrita, it describes how all the different expansions, even Lord Balaram, they all worship Lord Krishna. Even though, in a sense, they are non-different, still they know they are derived from or perceived from the Lord. He said, this is clear about this issue Anukata. That's why you have this verse, Ete Chamsakala Pumsan Krishna Sti Bhagavan Swayam. All these are either Kala or Amsha, but Krishna's Bhagavan Swayam. He's distinguished from them as being not a Kala or an Amsha, but Bhagavan Swayam. Nevertheless, they're Vishnu Tattva. They are none different. They're not different, and they're none different. But in all of those, Krishna is described as the original. And different examples are given, but he's described as the original. Krishna, of course, the in the Bhagavatam, there are arguments for why Krishna is supreme. It's not just that we say it because he's our favorite, but there's arguments. And the main argument that I remember from the Bhagavatam, the direct argument, is inciting the sages at Dandakaranya Forest who could not enjoy a conjugal relationship with Ramchandra, because he was limited in the amount of relationships he could have. And so they had to wait for Krishna in order to fulfill their desires. So in the other avatars' expansions, it's not that they aren't plenary, that is in full power, but not everything is manifest in them. Now the other argument for explaining how Krishna is supreme, this to me is a very convincing argument, is that there's one Lord, but there are not many gods. There's one. But what they are, the same Lord has many different relationships with different devotees, and therefore is manifest differently. He does it simultaneously. Sometimes we have many different relationships with different kinds of people, and we do it sequentially. We can't do it all at once. Because sometimes Prabhupada uses this example of a judge in the court. When he's on the bench with his black robes and maybe a ridiculous wig, everybody has to say, "Your Honor, to please the court." But then he changes clothes and goes out with his friends. And even if it's the same lawyer, they have a very different relationship. He dresses differently, he talks differently. So we stay in sequence a number of different relationships where our language is different, our dress is different, our behavior is different, our association is different. Maybe we belong to a super club where a man dresses up in women's clothes, you don't know. Or mild-minded stockbrokers, you know, pick up guitars and play heavy metal rock. These things happen. So these are different relationships, because God has so many devotees and so many different relationships. He does these all at once. But the one who has what Krishna represents is really the private life of God. It's the same as Vishnu, but Vishnu is formal and official. But Krishna is his private life. What does the Queen of England do when she's not playing at being the Queen? That's her private life. Otherwise, you meet her at court, and you have to say Your Majesty, and you have to genuflect, or you bow, or curtsy, and all that stuff, and treat her with great respect and formality. And if you're received at court, you made it. You know, you're like a big thing. You've been received at court, given some recognition, knighted or something, Sir Ringo or whatever the Beatles were. But if somehow or other you are so well connected that you're received at home, you sit with the royal family around the breakfast table playing with the corgi dogs and whatever else, then you're really in. That's higher. See, although Krishna is more informal and relaxed, that doesn't mean he's less than the majesty of Vaikuntha. This is his private life with his intimate associates. He's God, but nobody cares about that. He does that over there somewhere. They love him because he's Krishna. They don't care that he's God. Every so often it occurs to them, they say, "Oh, cool," then they forget about it. That's what happens with them. So therefore, that's higher. Otherwise, everybody wants to know. There was this TV series in America, The Private Lives of the Rich and Famous. You know, everybody's curious to know. They got these obnoxious photographers taking pictures of the royal family with telephoto lenses, and everybody wants to know their private life. But you're excluded. They tried to anyway, unless you're very well connected. That's the argument why Krishna is the highest.
I was I'd like to ask a question. At one time, the devotee told me that that the Krishna Loka planet, sometimes we have this conception that, you know, there's millions of Vaikuntha Galata planets, and then there's one planet called the Krishna Loka planet. But there's one devotee once told me, and I want to see if this is true or not, that actually the Krishna Loka planet, there are more people or more souls relating to Krishna in that planet than there are in all the Vaikuntha planets. Is that true?
I've never heard that.
Oh.
I've never heard a soul count.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are the previous nine chapters into the panel on the 10th?
Are they?
Sorry, not chapters, cantos.
Are they?
Are they much independent, interdependent on the 10th? Or is that the 10th stands in itself on its own above, supreme above all others?
Well, in order to appreciate the 10th for what it is, you have to have understood the previous nine. First, you have to you have to understand who Krishna is. You have to understand this idea that he is, in fact, the summum bonum. And enter into the proper relationship to him as master and servant. And then you can forget. So the people who try to not bother with the other nine and just go to the 10th, of course, Prabhupada rejects this approach. So the other nine there are for the purpose, so you can understand the complete science, the complete understanding of what it means to say that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all those details and just what it's entailing. Because first you have to surrender to Krishna. And then, after surrendering, a relationship develops. Then in the intimacy of that relationship, then it's not exactly that you don't know that Krishna is God, you just don't care. It's just not of interest. There's other things about him that are so much more amazing than the fact that he's God. I mean, the fact that he's God, you know, has so much power and everything, that's already mind-boggling. But there's something else that's so even more spectacular that happens when you makes all that look like nothing. You can just imagine. You know, this is the place where all the building stones are Chintamani and all the trees in the forest are Kalpavrikshas and all the cows are Surabhi cows and all the village girls are Lakshmis. It's just the beginning. And nobody cares that they're that. And so this is his position. Prabhupada mentions here, we have these nine topics. And you may notice, like, if you pull down the contents little flap here and you go to Srimad Bhagavatam, you see the titles of the things? So Canto 1, Creation. Sarga 2, the Cosmic Manifestation, the Sarga. Stanam gets translated as the status quo and why. I don't know for the life of me. Poshanam is translated as the creation of the fourth order. I didn't even know what that means. What's the fourth order? Maybe. Well, where's that in that canto even?
Isn't it the canto with...
Well, it's got all kinds of things in there, you can see. But I don't know what's the creation of the fourth order in there. Maybe, I don't know, the activities of the Pachetas?
Yeah,
it seems
to have something with
it. There's talks between...
But how is that potionum? I mean, in a sense, that's a topic there. There's Daksha's sacrifice story. There's the Dhruva Maharaj story. So these are all stories of the favor of the love for the devotees. and the Lord toward the devotees. King Venu, Prithu.
I think King Garanjana meant somebody.
Garanjana, I don't know. Maybe you can look it up and see what the titles are. But anyway, it's called Creation of the Fourth Order. That's the one that's not intuitively obvious why that means. The creative impetus, that's Uti. Prescribed duties for mankind, Manu, Manvantara. The science of God, Ishanupata. Withdrawal of the cosmic creations, the Nirodha. Liberation, Mukti, and the Summum Bonum. So these cantos are titled that way. Now, things don't line up quite that neatly, you know, there's not all these topics only restricted to each canto, but that's how they title them. And the last two are sort of supplementary to these 10 topics. Yeah?
What is the status quo mean in the translation tonight?
Status quo means the situation now. The current situation is the meaning of the status quo. And so he uses that as the translation of stanam, the middle stable period between creation and destruction. Yeah?
I'm just looking in front of me at a quote from this 12th canto, chapter 7, text 11. And it says that Shivajiva Goswami has explained that the 10 principal topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are found within each of the 12 cantos. One should not try to assign each of the 10 topics to a particular canto.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It looks like for some reason we have that.
I just think this is a kind of ceremonial way of titling the cantos.
Is it Prabhupada?
Huh? No, I think it's before Prabhupada. Prabhupada didn't do this. I'm pretty sure that this is a traditional way of doing it.
Also, Jiva's on the statement is what it means is that you can't. Just what you said before. That these may be general
thing, but it's not. You usually find these things in that chapter, but it's certainly not the only thing.
I mean, Jiva Goswami makes the point that the 10 topics are found in the Chaturshloki itself.
Yeah. So. I mean, in the Canto 1, you don't see much about Sarga either. It all shows up in Canto 2. You see what I mean? I just think it's a kind of a way of celebrating the 10 topics, Srimad Bhagavatam, or commemorating them or something like that, by giving titles to the chapters like that. I don't know how they got that way. I have no idea. I just wanted to show you that they are.
No,
way.
But I mean, in reality, if it is done or not. I mean, to show particular.
No, I don't know of any.
Jiva Goswami.
And Jiva Goswami says, don't do it.
Well, but what he does do is he takes the first verse of Bhagavatam and shows how each word corresponds to one of these things. He takes the Chaturshloki and says that each of the 10 topics are found in seed form in the Chaturshloki.
But he says he should not do it.
But he said, what he says is that don't expect that the only thing you'll find in the first canto is Sarga. The only thing you'll find.
You don't hardly find Sarga in the first canto.
You find it in the first verse, but.
Yeah, that's it. You know, the rest goes on to other things, you know. The history of the Bhagavatam, Maharaj Pariksit. The whole story is right there. You don't know why it has a purpose for being in there, but. The whole story is in there about Draupadi and the whole incident with what to do with Ashwatthama, which is more like Poshanam.
Yeah.
So here now, let's go and look at these, the definitions of these. The Prabhupada has them in the purport here in this, and we'll go to Bhagavatam. Here we go. So this one, now first one, this one requires Bhuta, Matra, Indriya, Diyam, Janma. Sarga Udarita. Sarga means the creation of the Bhutas, the five ghost elements. Matra, the Tan Mantras, the object perceived by the senses. And Indriya, the senses, and Diyam, like the creation of the mind, too. The element creation of the six items of matter, namely the five elements, sound, form, taste, smell, touch, and the eyes, ear, nose, tongue, skin, and mind, is known as Sarga. Here, Sarga, here means now in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Sarga, Prabhupada summarizes as the first creation by Vishnu, the bringing forth of the five gross material elements, the five objects of sense perception, the ten senses, the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, and the total material energy or universal form. That's Sarga. I think I've got a little thing here. Maybe it's in this one. Yeah, let's see. Yeah, here you can see, this is Sarga, really is these things here. The Pradana, the Mahatattva, then there's Ahankara, then Ahankara. This is all from the third canto. But this is what ends up as Sarga. Vaikarika, which means out of the transformation, the mode of goodness, is mind and the devatas. Devatas in some as powers or something before they're really working, because everything else has to be. Then out of the mode of passion, buddhi, and the gyanindriya, the knowledge acquiring senses. And then the karmindriya, the active senses, speech, touch, walking, so on. But it's mentioned that prana is the backup force for them in the same way that buddhi is for the knowledge-acquiring senses. But prana, this should be in brackets because it's not really listed as an element. But it's mentioned in the third canto as being there. The prana is obviously some form of air, so... Anyway, then in the mode of ignorance, tamasa, transformation, there these are the tan mantra, mean the sense objects, sound, objects of touch, form, odors and taste and odors, and then the growth, this is the panchamahabhuta, these five here. This is as you can, so that's really Sarga. That's physics.
Under Jendriya, what is Shrota,
Twa, Chakshu? Oh, this is a Sanskrit. I just put it in Sanskrit. Shrota means the sense of hearing. Ears, Twa, the sense of touch. Chakshu, the eye, the sense of seeing. Rasana, the sense of taste. And Grahana, the sense of smell. I just put these are Sanskrit words for these.
Right. Tamasa and then you said Rajasa and something?
Yeah, in the third canto, the transformation mode of goodness is called Vaikarika. And transformation the mode of passion is called Taijasa, and mode of ignorance is called Satamasa. I don't know why the difference in terminology, but that's... But the things that are in bold are really what's created these, that's the, you know, if you count them up, 5, 10, 15, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. There they are.
This is the Vedic periodic table, right?
More or less, yeah. Uh-huh.
In the Bhagavad Gita, when the elements are listed, it seems to be like they're from gross to subtle.
Yeah.
And so mind usually comes before intelligence as seeming to be more close.
It is.
But here, manas is coming from a mode of goodness.
Yeah.
Buddhi is coming from a mode of passion.
Isn't that interesting? And ahankara is way up here in the 40 modes. Because these are three divisions of ahankara. But you should understand this, although we want to go from the middle platform to the platform of buddhi. My understanding is that buddhi's main function, as Kapila Devi explains, it helps the knowledge acquiring senses to work. So it's connected with the activities of the senses. And the activities and the senses themselves are created out of the mode of passion. And they couldn't work. The knowledge acquiring senses couldn't work without buddhi. Because buddhi governs recognition, for example. Whereas manas, if the mind is in its pure state, then you can understand Krishna. The yoga system focuses on the mind. And the intelligence is used to purify the mind. And when the mind is pure, then it's... can recognize transcendence. Also, later on in this chapter, the same division will show up under the name as this first one here, over here, and this one is Adidaivika. This one here, Adiatmika. And this one here, Adi Bhautika, or Adi Bhuta.
Sometimes when I hear something springs from the mode of ignorance, I get a little confused because, for example, Shabda is sound. And sound is like a very, very subtle...
It's the subtle form of the subtlest element, which is ether.
Yeah.
It comes down from subtle to gross.
So what I'm just trying to say, just because something springs from the mode of ignorance doesn't mean that it's in the mode of ignorance.
No, it's a transformation of the mode of ignorance. But it's gross matter and the objects of perception. It's what gives you the bod. Which we know is gross.
Okay.
It's gross. Okay. Anyway, I don't mean to add, but this is sarga. That's what's created is sarga. It's really our version of physics. Visarga, the secondary creation, or the work of Brahma in producing the moving and unmoving bodies in the universe, Brahmanda. And so here also, back to here, Visarga is here, Prabhupada describes it as recreation. And Parusha. See, subsequent results in interaction. The way Visarga Parusha Smitaha is the work of the one who comes from the Parusha, who is the first Parusha. Well, anyway, Prabhupada explains all this here. The original creation is directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or Param Brahman, and the secondary creation as a reactionary result of the original ingredients is made by Brahman. thus the activities of the whole universe is started. So this is how the creation story happens. And we've already got it in this canto. Stiti is another way of saying sthana. And here is defined as Vaikuntha Vijaya. The victory, Vaikuntha here means the Lord of Vaikuntha. You can do that in Sanskrit. Vaikuntha means he who has or is the Lord of Vaikuntha. Vijaya means the victory of the Lord of Vaikuntha. In other words, in the sthana, that means the maintenance by Vishnu. This is the time when Vishnu is clearly predominating over Brahma and Shiva. Brahma is in his own in the beginning, in the Visarga. Shiva is on his own. We've already had that verse. Remember, in the beginning, there is Lord Brahma and the Prajapatis. In the middle, there is Vishnu and the Manus and the Rajarshis. And in the end, there is Lord Shiva and the atheist full of anger. So that's why the sthana, the maintenance of the period of maintenance, is called Vaikuntha Vijaya. Although here Prabhupada wants to emphasize another aspect of that, the right situation. Because stiti is another way, like we say somebody is well situated, we do that in English. The right situation for a living entity is to obey the laws of the Lord and thus be in perfect peace of mind under the protection of the personality of Godhead. So there he just moves right, segues right into posana and calls it maintenance. Here, Prabhupada has been more analytical in his presentation. Sthana, the maintenance of the universe by the personality of Godhead, Vishnu. Vishnu's function is more important and his glory greater. See, this is the Vaikuntha Vijaya. Vishnu's function is more important and his glory greater than Brahma's and Lord Shiva. Because although Brahma is the creator and Lord Shiva is the destroyer, Vishnu is the maintainer. So therefore, this Prabhupada is explaining really Vaikuntha Vijaya. And then Poshana, what it says in the Sanskrit is Tat Anugraha. It means the Lord's mercy. The Lord's mercy. Tat Anugraha has caused this mercy. And so Prabhupada explains this. Poshana, special care and protection for devotees by the Lord. As the king maintains his kingdom and subjects, but nevertheless gives special attention to the members of his family, for the personality of Godhead gives special care to his devotees who are souls completely surrendered to him. Okay. And then Uti, impetus is, I think this is in a different sequence here, let's see. They give them here in this here Manu Antara, the reign of the Manus. Again, Prabhupada's, it's described as Sat Dharma. It's characterized by Sat Dharma, the right directions of life. Here, Prabhupada says, Manu Anvantara, the periods controlled by the Manus who teach regular principles for living beings who desire to achieve perfection in human life. The rules of Manu, as described in the Manu Samhita, guide the way to such perfection. I think in this little paper here I have, described the Yuga cycles. Then the Manvantaras. So a Manu, 71 Divya Yugas, or Yuga cycles. you multiply 14 by 71, because of 14 manners, you get 994. So where are the six missing yuga cycles? Well, what happens is the day of Brahma actually contains only 994 complete yuga cycles. The missing time, equal to the duration of six Divya Yugas, or six yuga cycles, is taken up by Sanjas. The Sanja is a juncture or a transitional period. For example, a day has three Sanjas, dawn, noontime, and dusk. As it says, Yasya Tri Sandhya. Also, within the duration of each yuga, there's a beginning and an ending sanja, each equal to a few hundred years of the gods. When we had the 500th anniversary of the appearance of Lord Chaitanya, the pundits here said that this is actually the beginning of the golden age of Lord Chaitanya, and the first 500 years was a sanja, a dawn. So in 1986, the golden age began. They're sanjas, okay. So there are sanjas in connection with the manvantaras. There's a sanja before each manvantara and one following the last. So there's 15 sanjas, and each one lasts 4/10 of a yuga cycle, which is the same as the length of one satya yuga. Yeah.
Where is it described?
What?
Where is it described?
I forgot where I got it from. Somewhere. It's described, I can't remember where it's described. I had a big discussion about Sadhguru about it. Yeah.
The Manu Samhita, how relevant is it for us or for
the people? Prabhupada says that we should follow it. And I understand there's a whole school of Dharma Shastra that people study them and comment on them and so on. And I've been given to understand by Bhakti Vijayapurna Maharaj and others that there's, first of all, a special way that Manu Samhita applies to Vaishnavas. And others have said that actually there's a modification for Kali Yuga in general.
Yeah. I think it's the Parashuras, Samhita, which says, it lists the yugas that each Dharma Shastra is appropriate for, and it says that the Manu Samhita is particularly for the Satya Yuga.
Is for?
Satya Yuga.
Satya Yuga.
I mean, of course it has universal principles in it.
So they're adapted in different ways for different, applied differently. Then I mentioned here in this little summary, each manvantara brings a change of cosmic administration. New people occupy the post of seven sages, and the devata is headed by Indra. Each manvantara is followed by a devastation, inundation up to Bhumandala. Up to Bhumandala.
Is the Earth planet? It's the Earth planet.
Huh?
Earth planet is not devastated.
No. But the lower waters and here's a list. The incarnations of the Lord that appear in each manvantara. Okay, so that's the manvantara. The uti, urges of creation or initiative power. That is the cause of all inventions according to the necessities of time, space, and objects. What it says in the Sanskrit, udayaha is karma vasanaha, the desire. Vasana is not exactly like a desire. Actually, it's
inclination.
A deep inclination or predisposition. To karma. as the impetus is for work, the fruit of work. Okay, so that's that one. Prabhupada gives him.
I was going to say that Prabhupada's wording of this, the right situation for the living entities is to obey the laws of Lord and must be in perfect peace of mind. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives a second meaning of Vaikuntha Vijaya, which means that the Lord conquers over the misery of the living entities.
That's nice. That's where he gets it from.
Peace of mind.
Okay. And Prabhupada has a long purport about the right way of work and what's sadharma. But so now the next part of the list, but let's take a break, huh? I think a 5 minute break and then we'll continue with this. Today while I was eating lunch, all of a sudden...
Yes, I'm going to be you.
No, I don't. I need somebody knows how to do head massages.
I know somebody, I'll talk to you.
No, because it's like really acute right now. It was not so bad, but all of a sudden it just... sprang into being... Yeah, it's here, like this whole side of my jaw is swollen, and I can't close my teeth together. It's called TMJ, temporal mandibular joint disorder. TMJD.
It's not inflammation.
It's an inflammation of this jaw joint. Yeah.
Junction.
The jaw. It's inflammation.
Special days in here. I have in the gallon also information that's just above the teeth.
Well, if you want me to, I'll do my bad head massage.
Yeah, we can try that too.
Okay.
Well, the first time I had this was just before I came to India. I usually go to an acupuncturist anyway, and he put all these needles along here.
And it
went away. That was great. Yeah. But now it happened again, and he's in America, so.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it will take to go away.
I know there's one man here I know. I'll talk to him. He's good.
But my acupuncture suggests we go to India, get somebody who gives a head massage. That's like a big thing in Bengal, right? Head massage. Bengalis do it. We got to find somebody else they're doing it, and that probably will help. Because you can feel like all the muscles up in here are all very tight.
Yeah,
this is all swollen. You can feel it's like a little sore all through here.
Blind uncle's better than no uncle.
And it's just like, really, I can't close my mouth. My teeth won't go together. My advice to you is don't grow old. Stop where you are.
Or die.
Yeah, there's a joke about two old guys meeting, and he says, how are you? He says, well, pretty young. They're hobbling around with that question. Harry, pretty well, considering the alternative. Well, I suppose you can always look at it that way, huh? I heard there was a Russian proverb that's translated in English as, live and scratch. When you die, the itching will stop.
Yeah,
I'm funny. You get these books that have all these Russian, live and scratch. When you die, the itching will stop. It doesn't stop though, it keeps on going. It's a Roman proverb.
Can do
it. Yeah. It keeps on going. Another one in this book I had of what claimed the Russian proverb said.
Well, you have some book on the Russian proverb.
Yeah, when I was a kid or something sitting around. But after you've had it for 7 years, you'll know what to do with it. Oh, you never heard that. Because you didn't wear a peasant or something.
Or maybe. But, I mean, that's not really a contemporary proverb. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe from the 19th century, huh?
Yeah. You get the...
Yeah, I think from one of the Sager and the Sanders. Could I copy it?
Yeah, sure.
Very helpful. We'll put all this stuff in there.
Yeah.
Appendix is next to him. Turn around the right way.
It's
a
different answer. Nobody's so far systematized Babylon, right? So much. We don't even know what of the ten elements were situated.
The ten what?
This, of these 10 elements, where you find them, you know, like a structure of Bhagavad that you know somehow.
No, they're really not like that. They're scattered all around. I mean, the next one, Isha Anukata, I probably better close this one down. And we'll go on here. Your start with the money. That's what I have in here. That's just a report.
It's got the Sagar also.
Huh?
Kalpa's got the Sagar also.
Yeah, that's at the top of the document.
This description that you give is really based, or it's you figured it out. This Sankhya.
No, that's right from the third canto. I just put it into a little chart.
You mean that there's a Sankhya in between of Manvantaras?
No, that's a Sandhya.
Sandhya.
Yeah, the
not Sandhya. Sankhya in Sandhya.
Yeah.
In between of.
I think I got it from Sadaputra. He told me where he got it from, and I don't remember. Yeah. The Prabhupada mentions the Sanya in a few places.
Yeah, you even hear that there's a Sanya.
But you see, if you multiply 71 by 14, you come up 6 jiva cycles short.
Yeah.
So you need to explain it.
But the cycle of yuga. Anyway, but we even hear that there's a Sanya in between the yugas as well.
Yeah, but that means that nothing happens. It's not that there's a real bad, but it's just really short.
You mean like one is decreasing and
there's a point where they join, but one is going down and then maybe there's some kind of cataclysm and then it goes up again.
But in between
Brahmataras,
it's really long, same that nothing's happening.
What?
In between the
Manvantaras. In the Manvantaras is a devastation, although not between everyone. I think Jiva, there's some Prabhupada says, Sridhar Swami says one thing, Jiva Goswami says something else about the devastation between the Maundras. And the conclusion, I think Jiva Goswami's, I have to look it up, let me find it. I don't know what the conclusion is now. Yeah, according to Sripad Sridhar Swami, this is 1.13.15. 1.3.15, excuse me. There's not always a devastation after the change of every mind. But Sri Jiva Goswami has given definite proofs from authoritative scriptures like the Vishnu Damodara, Markandeya Purana, Harivansha, that there is always a devastation after the end of each and every manu. So that's the conclusion. Srila Vishnachakravarti has also supported Srila Jiva Goswami, and he, Sri Chakravarti, has also quoted from the Bhagavatamrita about the inundation after every manu.
How
okay.
Do you reconcile it? I mean, they boast, right? You know, like when acharyas,
approved
acharyas become different
opinions? Well, usually if there seems to be some disagreement, so usually the first thing you do, the rule is when you find some disagreement in Shastra, is you try to find a way to reconcile them, how they're both true. Yeah. And then finally, you know, like in this case, because Jiva Goswami is working under the authority of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, one might think that he has superior information. And he quotes other Shastras too, that maybe Sridhar Swami didn't refer to, and so on. So.
At the same time, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu considered Sridhar Swami's comments.
He did. But that doesn't mean that, he was limited to.
And Jiva Goswami in the stuff of Sundarbas says in early on that he'll follow the commentary of Sridhar Goswami insofar as it represents the pure Vaishnava Siddhanta. Uh-huh. Sort of implies that occasionally when Sridhar Goswami is addressing, you know, his sort of his own school, that he'll feel, you know, the freedom to go in a different direction.
Like the later commentaries.
In either case, you know how to go back to Godhead if you want to.
For sure.
Okay, so.
That's the best answer to all the questions.
On that matter, there's not any confusion, huh? Now, the next one is. Now it's describing Isha Katha. Here it just calls it Isha Katha or Isha Anukata. The science of God, as Prabhupada says here, is said to be the accounts of the activities of the Lord in his various avatars, as well as the activities of his great devotees. Anuvartana, those who are his followers. The persons who are his followers, Anuvartinam Bhumsam. So that includes, when there are descriptions of Isha Anukata, it's not just the activities of the Lord, but also his great devotees. So Nisringa and Prahlad, Dhruva, Krishnagarbha, so this way the devotees are always there with this Isha Anukata. In the CC, he describes it as scriptural information regarding the personality of Godhead, his incarnations on earth, and the activities of his devotees. Scriptures dealing with these subjects are essential for progressive human life. Then, Narodha.
Okay.
Yeah.
I could just respond to this question about the passage before.
Yeah, about the...
Sridhar Swami presents it hypothetically. He says, even if there isn't, still, it could be answered that in this particular case.
Oh, I see.
So he's Sridhar Swami is fairly non-committal, and Jiva Goswami's response is to just say, well, no, there is, every time.
Just so, see, like, oh. Another doubt removed. Now you can surrender.
That was like early in the first canto.
Huh?
So that one's early in the first canto. You haven't built up yet.
He mentions this, huh? So Sridhar tried to push it like that, in a hypothetical way. Like he's not quite sure whether there is or isn't. But Jiva Goswami says, yep, there definitely is. Okay. Prabhupada, this is the. He talks about this Isha Anagata makes history worth reading. It's the history that's worth reading. Otherwise, history is not worth reading. According to him, it's the great devotees and the Lord that makes it. Because it says it should be remembered, always be remembered that the material creation is created for the salvation of the conditioned souls. Now, Nirodha, the winding up. I love this one, huh? The Anushayanam, the lying down of the Purusha incarnation of Mahavishnu in mystic slumber. And together with the living entities and the energies, the material energies. That's what that is. I think Jimmy says the same thing. The winding up of all energies employed in creation. See, you see, the spider example, they unwind and they wind back up again. So they pop into being and pop out of being. They come out and they come back in. Such potencies are emanations from the personality of Godhead who eternally lies in the Karana ocean. The cosmic creations manifest with his breath are again dissolved in due course. When we come to Mukti, and this is a famous definition.
That would mean, but also like the time of the night time of Brahma, when there's, is that also that being that category? It's like the winding up of the partial.
Yeah, there's also the road that is described that way. But it's not the total winding up, but partially. Brahma goes back into the lotus flower.
But he winds it up at the very end.
At the very end, this was really, I think, is talking about the very end of the life of Brahma. The universe is dissolved.
And he winds it up.
Because during Brahma's night, it's not really the sarga that's not wound up. But here the sarga is wound up, so it's balanced with this sarga.
The living end is the night,
and
during
Brahma's
night, where do they go at that time?
They're not annihilated.
I mean, their bodies are annihilated.
They go back into the lotus flower. Yeah. And they come back out again. And when they come out, as described, they look bluish. Because they have their karma clinging. They still have their subtle bodies, and their karma is clinging to them. So because of their contamination, they have a bluish hue. It's in Bhagavad, I forgot exactly where. Then here's, Prabhupada quotes this next one, Muktiya Hitvanyata Rupam Swarupena Dhyastitaha. This is the definition of Mukti. Liberation. is the giving up of the anyata rupam, you can say the extraneous form, and swarupena vyasatata, and becoming, returning to his permanent situation in his swarup, his real original form. There's the anyata rupam, the extraneous form, which Prabhupada calls the changeable, gross, and subtle material bodies. And in the permanent situation, the form of the living entities. Many times Prabhupada quotes this. This is where it is, his definition of liberation. It's not dissolution, disappearance. It's real liberation. This is the Bhagavatam's own definition. It's not an impersonal idea. Liberation of the conditioned soul encaged by the gross and subtle coverings of body and mind, when freed from all material affection, the soul giving up the gross and subtle material body. As we mentioned, you get rid of gross bodies all the time, but because of material affection, the subtle body remains, clings to the soul because of the not a false ego, and therefore acquires another gross body in the course of time. But when the soul gives up the gross and subtle material bodies, can attain the spiritual sky in his original spiritual body and engage in transcendental loving service to the Lord in Vaikuntha Loka or Krishna Loka. When the soul is situated in his original constitutional position of existence, he is said to be liberated. It is possible to engage in transcendental loving service to the Lord and become Jivan Mukta, a liberated soul, even while in the material body. Because a person, like for example, one who's fully liberated soul has two existences. This body, in which he's practicing as a devotee, known as the Sadhaka Deha, which is fully engaged in Krishna service. And there's a citadel in the spiritual world. He's there in both places. We mentioned that. The question comes up, I think it's in Baladeva Vibhushana commentary. Which one? Vedanta Sutra. I forgot, I read it. He says, he answers the questions that actually when a soul becomes liberated, then the karma is all gone, then immediately he should leave his body. Because the body and mind are just going on by your past karma. So that's finished when you're liberated, utterly finished, so they should just go. And you return on back to Godhead. But we have Jivan Mukta, we see that there are liberated souls on earth. How does that happen? And Baladev says that they are not going on by their karma. Krishna keeps them going. Krishna directly keeps their bodies going and everything. Otherwise, if he did not do that, there would be no great souls on the planet to help other people. You know where this is? Anyway,
I know this actually.
That's his answer to that question. How can there be Jivan Mukti if there's no more karma? For those devotees, their bodies are simply directly, they're not going on by karma anymore. They're going on by Krishna's desire. Okay, those are the 10 topics. Let's see what Prabhupada says in this purport. Here he talks about the two types of living entities, Nitya Muktas, Nitya Bhavas, and so on, and the point of the existence. Okay, now he says in the seventh one, the Supreme One, who is celebrated as the Supreme Being or Supreme Soul. Is the supreme source of the cosmic manifestation as well as its reservoir and winding up. Thus he is the supreme fountainhead and absolute truth. Now here he defines, what is the Ashraya? Param Brahman Paramatma. Paramatma iti. He's the supreme Brahman. And is he who is the yataha, the source of abhasa, the sending forth in a way, the cosmic manifestation of light rays coming out of him, and nirodha, it's winding up. So here he describes now the tenth topic, the ashraya, that is to say, the classic definition of the absolute truth. It's another way of saying janmadasya yataha. That from which everything has its origin. Janmadasa yataha, janmadi asya, yat ataha, means it's birth, etc. Janma adi. That from which comes birth, etc. means maintenance and destruction. So that's the classic definition here. And Prabhupada says here, it's right there in the beginning, Janmad Yasha Yatara, quoted in the, and then Vedanta Tattva Vidas Tattva Jnanam Advayam. And so, then he also puts Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam, that Krishna is that Bhagavan. The original source of all energies, summum bonum, as the absolute truth. Bhagavan is the last word of the absolute truth. And even with the synonyms for Bhagavan, such as Narayan, Vishnu, and Purusha, the last word is Krishna. Then he quotes the Bhagavatam as the sound representation of Krishna. So Prabhupada has said, to explain Krishna or the science of Krishna, the Srimad Bhagavatam has been prepared. And then the first canto, this truth is indicated in the questions and answers by Suta Goswami and the great sages like Shanika. And in the first and second of the chapters of the canto, this is explained. The third canto, the subject is more explicit. Fourth, even more explicit. Further emphasized in the summary of the Srimad Bhagavatam in four verses, as we have already discussed, is succinct. Then he goes on like this, explaining how in every canto the Lord is the ultimate summum bonum, the ultimate source of all energy, and how he's indicated there one after the other in that way. So that's his explanation. Now, so now we really have a summary of these 10 topics. Now in the text 8, if the previous verse was describing the ashraya, this verse describes the asrita, that which is sheltered. And here it's mentioned in these three divisions. These words will come up later, and they were mentioned earlier in the purport. These three divisions called adi-atmika, daivika, and Adi Bhautika. The individual person possessing different instruments of senses is called the Adi Atmic person. That's the embodied living entity. with his senses for action. He's called Adiatma, from the word Atma. And the controlling deity of the senses is called Adidaiva. Every sense has got its controlling deity. The eyes, every single one. This mention that they're all some personified form of those is gathered around Vishnu and Vaikuntha Loka in Brahma season. The embodiment seen on the eyeballs, that means to say the object of what you see when you look at somebody. It's, people really look for esoteric meanings for that. The visible, the gross, you know, the made of the objects of sense perception, is called the adibhautik. Person. That is the body, or that which is composed of the gross elements and the sense objects, the tan mantras. Remember, the sense objects are considered to be it emits sounds, it has color and shape, it smells good or bad, so on. This is the sense objects. Huh?
You mentioned earlier that these three relate to sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic.
Yeah, right. They evolve out of the adidaivic is produced out of the mode of goodness, the mind and the controlling deities described as coming out of false ego in goodness, and when false ego in passion. Come the 10 sets of the 10 set of senses plus buddhi.
Which one is Adiyatmika or any?
Huh?
That's Adiyatmika? Purush?
No. Yeah, well, the Purusha with his senses, you know. It's actually you're referring to the Purusha. But he's the one that's got these senses. Yeah. It's the conditioned person. So he's bristling with these senses. And looking for a good time. That's what I say, are you looking for a good time? Once we had a Food for Life Center, it was a very rough part of town, and right behind the center there were all these, you come up to the center and these prostitutes, you stop at a stop sign, and all these prostitutes, you come up to your car. They leave your car and say, you guys looking for a good time? We say, no, we're Hare Krishnas. Oh, all right. Are you guys looking for a good time? After a while, they just waved. So that's the one who's looking for a good time in the conditioned soul. And then the adibhauta is really the gross and subtle material elements, the objects of the senses and the gross elements behind them. When we talk about the senses here in this respect, we mean powers, the power of seeing. Now the power of seeing gets instilled into a certain structure, which is the adibhautik person. We call them eyes, huh? Two eyes. But there's, you know, there's some have more than two, some have less than two, some have very primitive eye spots. Fly has, you know, all these eyes. And we talk about the powers of motion. We have legs, but there's all kinds of legs. And you know, a snake has got his power of motion somewhere else. And of course, some entities like trees, they have no power of motion whatsoever. It's just shut down entirely. unless of course you've seen Lord of the Rings. They're not really these particular. We say, you know, for they say using karo, meaning two hands. But they're really the instruments to manipulate. Well, some living entities, they don't have hands, they have pinchers. And some, the elephant uses his trunk for his karo. Well, in fact, there's a name. What's his name? He has his hand. Knows his name. There's some name for an elephant.
An elephant is called either husky.
Huh?
An elephant is called either kari or husky.
And husky means?
Husky is hand. Kari is hand.
His hand, right? Because you see, it's his hand. But anyway, so they are actually these powers are put into the living entities in different ways. The senses are really those potencies. That are there. So this is what really the world is assembled out of. In three classifications. And so then he starts with the controlling summum bonum, the personality of Godhead. And so Prabhupada explains this here. But all the controlling deities are manifestations of the Paramatma feature, who exhibits such and such a matter by entering into each and every universe generated by him. He's talking now about Adidaivika. But still, apparently, there are divisions of the controller and the controlled. For example, in the food controlling department, the controller of food is a person made of the same ingredients as the person who is controlled. Similarly, each and every individual in the material world is controlled by the higher demigods. So this is the Adidaivika system. We cannot see without light, and the supreme controller of the light is the sun. The sun god is in the sun planet, and we, the individual human beings, or any other being on earth, are all controlled by the sun god as far as our eyes are concerned. So he's the controller here. Similarly, all the senses we have are controlled by superior demigods, who are as much living entities as we are, but one who is empowered while the other is controller. The controlled living entity is called the Adiatmic person, and the controller is called the Adidaivic person. Now, I don't know this. This is one question we have to answer, and I'm answering my Vedic research. But who controls the senses of the demigods? Is it Vishnu directly? The whole biology of demigods is a question. They're wired into the universe in a really different way than we are, because of the controlling systems. And apparently their senses are such that if something happens at a distance from their body, they still can sense it. So they have some more degree of pervasiveness. How they do that, I don't know. But they really are very different from us. Okay? Anyway, the controlling living entity is the Adiatmic. Controlled is the Adiatmic, the controlling Adidaivik. All these positions in the material world are different fruit of activities. Any individual living being can become the sun god, and so on. Everyone, and distinct us to the ultimate controller. That which distinguishes the controller and the control, that is, the material body, is called the Adibhautik Purusha. And he mentions here another word, the body is sometimes called Purusha, as confirmed in the Vedic hymn, Savaya Esha Purusho Ananya Rasamayaha. This body is called the Ananda Rasa embodiment, the body that depends on food. Oh, is this the Taittiriya punishment? Yeah. The living entity, which is embodied, does not eat anything, however, because the owner is spirit and efforts. But the material body requires replacement of matter for the wearing and tearing of the mechanical body. Anyway, so he goes on to explain this. So the Supreme Person is different from all three because he's the shelter of all, and all three are coming out of his energies. It's the sum and substance of that. Now you'll see these terms come up again later in this chapter, because we'll get another description of the universal form and these three divisions. It's about the creation of the universal form. That it ends up this way. Finally, let's go to text 9 here. All the above three mentioned stages of different living entities, all the above three mentioned, are interdependent. In the absence of one, another is not understood. So these three things, that they're working together. The living entity in his senses, the materials of which that living entity's body is made out of, and so on, and the controlling deities. They're interdependent. You have to understand what this means. We cannot blink an eye without the god who's in control of eyelashes doing this. We can't to hear, to move our hand, everything. There's a whole cognitive mechanism at work. But who sees every one of them as the shelter of the shelter is independent of all, and therefore he is the supreme shelter. He's the Atma, and he is the Ashraya. Why Ashraya, Ashraya? He is the shelter of himself. In other words, he doesn't take shelter of anyone else. But he's distinguishing the others who are Ashuta, under the shelter of the Supreme. What it's saying, right? Okay, you clear on that? So the 10 topics, the 10 categories, or 9 categories in one substance, and then those 9 categories are part of the system described as Adibhautik, Adiatmic, Adidaivic. earlier that we've had this thing called Jnana Shakti, Priya Shakti, and Drobya Shakti. And when Prabhupada comments on those, I don't know which text they are earlier in this canto, when he comments on those, he comments them, he describes it as Jnana Shakti powers, I mean certain kind of the powers of knowledge. He also describes them as Adidaivik, the controlling system. Kriya Shakti, which are the powers of action, as the Adiyatma. And Drobya Shakti, Drobya means matter or substance, as the Adi-Bhuta, Adi-Bhuta. So really, at least in the purport, these terms have been introduced. But in the text, it says, it talks about Jnana, Kriya, and Drobya Shaktis. And so another terminology. So those are the ones for the system of the world. So now we'll put them to use. Yeah?
That's related to Kriya Shakti is like the power of the senses?
Yeah. Kriya means action, doing something. Or you're doing something only by these powers of the senses, right? Anything else? Any questions? Yeah.
So the demigods in their particular field of influence are practically all knowing.
Yeah. What they know about. Right? It's just like in anybody, you know, if you get a piece of machinery, you know, in the government, you know, some electrical station, some electrical substation. The guy who runs it, you know, he knows all about it. He like really is into it, how it works, everything. In his little area to function, he has to be practically omniscient. This kind of little area. So the demigods, in the Bible, in one of the letters of St. Paul, the Greek word he uses for these beings is cosmocrates, cosmocrats. You know, we have like bureaucrat, they're cosmocrats. They run all the universe, and somehow or other they're wired into it. Their senses are wired or extended in such a way that they are in their own sphere of things, all pervading. In that limited way, they're pervading and aware. It's almost like they had extended bodies. If you say a body is that part of material nature of what you're most immediately conscious of, you have to say they have extended bodies. Whereas the Lord's, since His consciousness is everywhere, the whole universe is body. But they have little areas which they have are like their bodies. Yeah.
Like Krishna explains in that, or he describes in the Gita, this Prakya Punya Pratamakam, that you know, they attain the heavenly planets, the fallen yogis. So, are all the residents of the heavenly planets demigods and they have responsibility?
No, I don't believe so. I think some are just there to goof off and have a good time. There's 33 crores of demigods. Some people say 33 million, but 33 crores is 330 million. That's a lot for us. I personally asked Prabhupada this question. We were walking and when he was visiting Philadelphia, I said to him, hey, if Krishna is all powerful, why does he need all these demigods
to run the universe. The Prabhupada just looked at me and said, you don't know how to run a universe. And I have to admit that's true. But that's how he does it. He does it by the demigods. The example that Prabhupada uses, you know, if you're in a city and you turn a switch and light comes, and you turn a faucet and water comes, you flush the toilet and it goes out, and there's, because there's a whole system there of light and sewage and water and so on. Maybe gas, electricity, heat. So naturally, I mean, there's certain mechanisms, but ultimately there's a department and there's somebody who has to run that department. It's just not totally impersonal. Even if it's to some extent computerized, somebody has to watch the computers and run them. So Prabhupada says, similarly, the universe acts, works in the same way. Another point, if the absolute truth is a person, then why shouldn't there be persons all the way through? Why not have these creators? These demigods, these controllers, I mean to say, all over the place. We're also persons. You see, what happened is, it used to be in the world that if you look in the record of all people, ancient people, they all believed this, that the whole nature of the universe was populated by these controlling beings. Even in the Greeks, every little stream, every grove of trees, it had its little local deity and things like that. And not only did everybody believe this, but everybody, they report that human beings had regular interactions with these. These are everywhere. These stories are there. Greeks and Now we don't see them anymore. Now it's just a daydream from the infancy, the cradle time of the human race. But the other explanation is, of course, that we don't see them because they're just not visible to us anymore. And as far as the devas, they don't visit here. They used to come down. The Greeks also, they tell these stories and not only intermingle with human beings, but beget children of them, heroes like Achilles and so many were, Helen of Troy were gods and human women. Zeus especially was fond of this stuff. And we see also in the Mahabharata, this is what, there's children like that. The Pandavas are children like that. Well, this is a common kind of idea all over the place. It doesn't happen anymore. It says during the Maharaj Prithu, even the ordinary person could see the gods. So, maybe not everyone could see them. But the people saw them, and we know what they look like. You can, a god has three lakshana, three signs. One, the feet, the demigod, the feet don't touch the ground. They're a little bit off the ground. Two, their eyes don't blink. This is mentioned in the Mahabharata. And three, their garlands never wither. you can tell people saw them.
Their garlands?
Their garlands are always fresh. They don't wither and die.
Only at the end.
Huh?
Only at the end. It's a sign that they have to go down.
I don't know about that. Yeah.
They cannot take anything from this world.
They cannot what?
They cannot eat anything.
Well, just I know this because of the story of Nalan Damayanti. this is mentioned that, you know, Damayanti was a beautiful princess and she wanted to marry Nala, the prince. But she was so beautiful, all these gods wanted to marry her too. And so at the time of her Swayamvara, all these gods came to her and they changed themselves so they looked exactly like Nala. And you couldn't tell one from the other. But such was her firmness of chastity that in the face of her deep dedication to Nala, the gods were not able to maintain their disguise. And suddenly you could see all of them lifting up off the ground and their eyes not blinking and their garlands fresh. And so she could see who was Nala. That's the story. And Nala Damayanti. Yeah. It was in the Sanskrit reader, so he translated it, and then he learned about the Devaikas. Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati mentions that story as an example of a mundane rasa. But anyway, it's in the Mahabharata. So the gods don't come here anymore. There are certain places that tourists don't visit. There used to be lots of tourists in Kashmir. They don't go there anymore. It's just, they don't go. You don't see them. They don't go to Sudan. They're not there. They don't go. Right? The gods don't come here. They're not visible anymore. And anyway, so at a certain period of human history, there was this thing that happened. A German sociologist called Entzauberung, the disenchantment of the world, or the de-divininization of the world. And it's a kind of making everything impersonal. Because then, you know, because, and this is part and parcel of the advancement of material science, because if everything is being controlled by gods, you know, then you have to act one way about the world. But if there are no gods, maybe there's one god way up there, but, you know, he's like remote and everything, you've de-divinized nature, then, you know, it's up for grabs. There's no control. You can start to try to control events and things like that. That's the attitude of modern science. So we live in this world now which has been undergone this historical process. So no one sees them anymore. However, if the Sankirtan movement is successful, they'll become visible again.
I remember one place that Prabhupada said, the demigods cannot take anything, cannot eat anything in this world, except the ghee in the mouth of Brahma.
Where's the word from demigod?
Huh?
Where's the word demigod from?
Well, Prabhupada uses it. Look in the OED. The word demi means partial. Deva is just really a god. But Prabhupada uses it to distinguish, so you will not think that they're somehow keep the idea out of your head, they're on the same or equal. What happened here, man? I got some wrong thing going on. I hit the wrong button. Where is this stuff? Okay. I'll look up the word demigod in the OED. Let's see where it shows up from first.
Stupid,
right? They don't say much. In ancient mythology, etc. Oh, see, demi is a rendering of the Latin semi-deus, semi-god.
You want to see, you can go see this link here. We can hit demi, this prefix, and we can see what it means. Various places. It means a single apart, huh? In that way. Now, how do I go back to where I was in this
thing? Entry history?
Huh?
Entry history.
History. Oh, right, here we go.
Entry
history? Oh, excuse me. It closes it down. Here's go back to demigod here. A being partially of divine nature. Well, that's the original usage. A minor or inferior deity, or a man, a mortal race of divine rank. So the original usage was like that, a god and a demigod. Yeah. So then Prabhupada uses it to distinguish the mini gods from the original god. Even somewhere I saw the usage semi-demigod. Because there's devas and there's upadevas. The minor, low level. And the word devata means divinity. Devata, he has godness, divinity. A divinity, sometimes use it as a noun too, as a singular, divinity. Devata. Okay?
So this 33 crores, it is inside this universe or all the universe?
Who? What?
33 crores of devatas, demigods?
I don't know if there are 33 crores just in this one. I would suspect, since the other universes are very big and Brahma has more head, that they probably have more devatas. But I don't know for sure.
Number would be the answer there.
Anyway, I don't need to, what difference?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got Ari Dharmic and Ari Atmic, but Ari Bodhic, like, in relationship to me, like, looking at him, he would be an Ari Bodhic.
Ari Bodhic.
Because he's on my eyes balls, right?
Because what you see are the sense objects. And those behind those sense objects are the elements that support them of earth, water, fire, air, and space.
Okay. So in an Adi-Bodhic perception in relationship to me, it also has to have senses and everything else?
No, he doesn't, because you can have an Adi-Bodhic impression of this computer also.
So
when it says Adibhautik Purusha, then it means really that, that person who are considered as simply a material body, independent from the living functions, supplied by the sensory powers. But the senses are subtle. In fact, they're in the subtle body. The powers of the senses are in the subtle body. It's part of the subtle body, but then they get expressed in a gross body according to the mentality that's there. In other words, the power for smell, that is to say, the desire for smell and somehow be able to do it is there. But you can have a nose like this, or you can have a nose that's way in front of your face, like a dog. Or you have a snout, or you have all kinds of noses, or olfactory things. But the sense of taste in a fish is not in the tongue. The fish have a stripe along their outside, and then that stripe are taste buds, because they live in water. So their bodies are tongues. And Prabhupada said this about fish. Fish life is all tongue. So for tasting, the fish has got the best body. Because taste, the flavors are conveyed in water. They're the tongue mantra of water, so if they're in water, they're really big at tasting. Yeah.
But so that the power of taste is gets embodied in different adibhautic structures, let's say. Because bhautik comes from bhuta. Bhuta means the elements, five growth elements, and then the sense objects that are associated with it. From sound, you'll study this from sound. We already have. From sound, a certain reaction, then space is manifest, and there's a transformation. And then after that, the object of the sense of touch are manifested in air. But what comes first is the tongue mantra and then the gross element. Okay, we continue tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.